This podcast was recorded at the 2015 Grad Pro Live at APSHA Conference. The title of this session is Immunotherapy for High-Risk Neuroblastoma, and it is presented by Rajan Modi, Erica Mora, Elizabeth Hollenkamp, and Rhonda McDougall, all of the University of Michigan. To view the presentation slides or to claim continuing educational credit for this activity, please visit www.advancedpractitioner.com/JADPRO Live 2015. And now, we're delighted to bring you this podcast from JADPRO Live.
Thank you, Wendy, for that nice introduction. And next, I want to introduce my team. On the furthest is Erica Mora, like Dr. Erica Mora, our clinical pharmacist. And she's actually in today's talk going to talk about dinutuximab administration and the side effect profile. Next, we have Elizabeth Hollenkamp, and she's our clinical nurse specialist, and she's a pain part of the pediatric pain team. And she helps us with our management of our patients with dinutuximab-induced pain. And next, we have Rhonda McDougall, our pediatric nurse practitioners and our solid tumor nurse practitioner in our oncology program, and takes care of all of our neuroblastoma patients. So thanks, everybody, for coming. And first of all, I wanted to thank the organizers for inviting us to give us the opportunity to present our work. And I think this is obviously relatively in topic, a topic in vogue, like a lot of things in immunotherapy has been talked about in various tumor models, whether it's neuroblastoma, whether it's ALL, or whether it's melanoma. And we thought this would be an opportune time with dinutuximab getting FDA approval, and a lot of the other centers are starting to use that for neuroblastoma and other indication. And what we wanted to do in this is wanted to truly present an interprofessional approach where when you treat these patients and how exciting the therapy and effective the therapy is certainly not easy. So I just wanted to ask, how many in the audience are taking care of neuroblastoma patients? So very few hands, and thanks for coming from my pediatric colleague. And we knew that I think this is primarily an adult audience, but I think again, like Wendy said, this is actually traveling for other indications, and so ultimately this and other immunotherapy is going to be part of your clinical practice, and hopefully we will all learn something today. So I'm just going to move to the next slide. This again, I think Wendy did a tremendous job, so we can move on. In terms of disclosure, I'm a scientific advisor for United Therapeutics, which actually makes dinutuximab. And I'm a study chair for Children's Oncology Group, ANBL 1221, which is actually a study which also uses dinutuximab. There are no other faculty disclosure. So in terms of learning objectives, what we're going to talk about today is, I think, especially with knowing that now we have predominantly an adult audience, we're going to define what is high-risk neuroblastoma and what is the role of immunotherapy in its management. And then we're going to review the mechanism of action of dinutuximab. That's going to be the first part of the slide, first part of our talk. And then I think Erica is going to take all of us through the side effect profile and administration of dinutuximab. Then we have some very nice patient vignette and mother's story. And I think we're going to talk about three patient vignette and a mother's audio recording. And Rhonda is going to do the patient vignette. And finally, we're going to talk about some multidisciplinary approaches and process improvements and how we actually ultimately arrive to where we are, where we are able to deliver this therapy very safely. And Beth is going to talk about those things. So just the primary neuroblastoma. So for compared to any adult cancer, even the most common pediatric cancer, ALL, is considered rare. So all pediatric cancer by NCI definition are rare disease, rare and orphan diseases. And neuroblastoma is the third most common with about 10.2 per million in kids who are less than 15 years of age. And exclusively, neuroblastoma is a young kid's disease. So almost everybody, we occasionally very, very rarely see an adult with neuroblastoma, but otherwise this accounts for all neuroblastoma patients that we see in North America. Neuroblastoma accounts for about 8% of all childhood cancer, And as I said, it's a young kid's disease, so close to 2 years of age at diagnosis. And 95% or more will be diagnosed before the age 10. Male to female ratio, very slight male preponderance. About 2% of the cases are familial in nature, associated with the ALK gene mutation. And they usually get diagnosed early, before the year. This is a busy slide that don't need to read this slide. What it talks about is two staging system for neuroblastoma. And compared to many of the TNM and other staging system that is more familiar, this is a different staging system. And what I think the one on the left actually shows is actually the current international neuroblastoma staging system, which actually post-operative system. So if you have a patient coming with a large mass and a surgeon does a fabulous job and resects that, you can actually downgrade that patient. Compared to the newer system, which we have moved to, International Neuroblastoma Research Group classification, is actually image-based, like most other tumor that you are familiar with. It's like when a patient comes in, has a CT, MRI, MIBG, you look at that stage and patient gets staged. And the staging there is pretty straightforward, localized tumor, regional spread, metastatic disease. And neuroblastoma has a special staging called MS, or 4S here for current classification, where you have young infants less than 18 months of age with skin, bone marrow, or liver metastasis, but they have excellent prognosis. The reason for this move is, I think, a lot of the times, the studies that come out of Europe, they use a different classification system, and North America uses different system. So now INRG is actually a combination. Both North America and Europe has agreed to use the same classification. This pie chart actually shows the risk stratification of neuroblastoma. Once a neuroblastoma patient gets diagnosed, it's stratified into low, intermediate, or high risk. Based on patient's age, age less than 18 months is good. Favorable histology is good. Stage 1 and 2 is relatively favorable compared to 3 and 4. NMIC, which is a transcription factor, gene amplification status. If you don't have amplification, that is good. You have ploidy, which is a DNA content. 1 or less is bad. More than 1 is good. And then you have some genetic changes on chromosome 1P and 11Q. If you don't have that, this is good. Based on all these factors, Children's Oncology Group and international experts would assign neuroblastoma patient either a low-risk stage, which is about 30% of the patients, intermediate risk, which is about 15%, and you have 55% of the patients who present with actually high-risk neuroblastoma. And this is actually the biggest problem with neuroblastoma, that most of the patients that you see in clinic, they already have 20 bone mets, bone marrow disease, multiple lymph nodes involved, and that's why sometimes local approach is just not enough. And as you can see here, neuroblastoma accounts for 15% of mortality, even though it accounts for only 8% of kids with cancer, so double for its incidence. And this actually shows, based on the previously described risk stratification, shows that if you are neuroblastoma with low risk, you have an excellent survival. Intermediate risk, similar, almost similar survival with a little bit more aggressive therapy, local as well as systemic therapy. And then you have the high risk. Despite multi-agent aggressive chemotherapy, bone marrow transplant, surgical resection, local radiation, you have not much to show for. And so this is where all our efforts need to go in. And I think most of the neuroblastoma researcher would focus their attention into the high-risk patients to improve their outcome. And this slide actually shows the evolution of treatment over the last 30, 35 years for neuroblastoma patients, where we started with, we started with the first three cycles, now which have moved to high multi-agent chemotherapy, and induction includes between 5 to 6 cycles based on what protocol you are on. And the chemotherapy agents that we use is vincristine, doxorubicin, cytoxan, cisplat, and etoposide. So the chemotherapy was not very different than what you guys are familiar with. And we use every cycle is given every 21 days. And then in 90s, role of BMT was more, better defined. In a randomized trial done by Kate Mathey, we showed that BMT actually improves the outcome. So BMT, bone marrow transplant, autologous bone marrow transplant, not allogenic, autologous bone marrow transplant became the standard of care for neuroblastoma. So they would get chemotherapy, they would get surgical resection, they would get local radiation, and they would get bone marrow transplant. And despite all this, and the last thing I should say, in 2000s, the role of cis-retinoic acid was better defined in a randomized trial, and so cis-retinoic acid also became the standard of care. So after patients finish that, they will be on oral Accutane for 6 cycles. With all that being done, the outcomes barely budged anything. And so I think from 20-25%, it moved to 36%, but not by much. And so this is when actually the onset and early trials from dinutuximab, which is also known formerly as Chimeric 1418, came along. And this really was much needed help the neuroblastoma community needed. And so just to talk about neuroblastoma and its immunogenicity. So neuroblastoma compared to adult tumor. So if you do, and I think most of the centers now doing some form of sequencing in like Foundation Medicine or whatever your program is doing, like if you look at a pancreatic or a lung cancer and you have 120 melanoma with like 200 mutations, neuroblastoma, you're talking 15 mutations. Some of the sarcomas, the same story. Pediatric tumors in general have less than 28 mutations. Neuroblastoma is even fewer than that. So when you have very few somatic mutation, your tumor is less immunogenic. And on top of that, you have young kids whose immune system is not very robust. So it really makes for a very poorly immunogenic tumor. And on top of that, neuroblastoma is unfortunately a clever tumor, and it actually secretes various substances which actually helps them hide their HLA antigen as well as adhesion and hide them from adhesion molecules, as well as secreting some substance which actually kills T and NK cells and also recruits some local macrophages which actually helps them kill lymphocytes. And so overall, if you look at this, this actually makes neuroblastoma a very poor target tumor for immunogenic therapy. So then you say, well, why are we trying immunotherapy in neuroblastoma? So the silver lining is the GD2, which is a surface carbohydrate antigen, which is present in 99% of neuroblastoma. And it is present in newly diagnosed as well as relapsed tumor, and very uniformly and very densely expressed antigen. And it is so close to related to surface, it is not T-cell dependent. That people thought late 80s in LSU and others at San Diego thought that this might be a good target to try. And I think more than anything else, I think these were desperate attempts, because at that time, all this chemo and things, nothing was working. So I said, well, we have to try something different. And again, I think this actually speaks to the history of immunotherapy in general. For the last 40 years, people who have been doing this long enough, they know immunotherapy is like this. Every 20 years, something comes up and people get all excited. And it's like over-promising, not delivering much. But I think last 10 years have been different. I think last 10 years, when you have the genetically modified molecules and newer way of treating, I think dinutuximab is just the first example. Everybody knows about CAR therapy for leukemia and all the PD-1 and CTLA-4s and other for melanoma. So now you can see that there are agents which actually has right targets. And I think this is where I think all the focus for neuroblastoma turned to be for GD2. And I think this slide actually shows various targets or various way neuroblastoma can be attacked using immunotherapy. And I think, again, a busy slide and very small to read, but I think you can see these pink dots are the GD2 receptors, which are densely and very nicely expressed on neuroblastoma cells. And then those chimeric antibodies then attach to them. And it just labels them that this is where the GD2 antigens are, and this is where this is the neuroblastoma cells. This combination and complex actually recruits your own normal immune cells. It recruits lymphocytes, it recruits neutrophils, it recruits macrophages, and ultimately helps them destroy it. It's known as antibody-dependent cellular cytotoxicity, ADCC, which is the predominant mechanism of action for dinutuximab. And then there are other approaches people have been using CAR therapy for neuroblastoma, using NK cell therapy for neuroblastoma, some vaccines. So people have been trying various approaches, and I think, but the most predominant and the most approved and proven option is the GD2, anti-GD2 therapy. And I think this slide, thanks to Alice, you who sent me a few of her slides for this presentation, showing the neuroblastoma staining, very dense population of neuroblastoma with the GD2 staining. And again, as we said earlier, GD2 is expressed on 99% of neuroblastoma. And it also is expressed, the GD2 is also expressed on some normal cells. And we'll talk about that leads to some troubles, skin, as well as peripheral nerves and brain tissue. Neuroblastoma is also expressed on other tumors, actually. And the other tumors that you see neuroblastoma is melanoma, osteosarcoma, and then it also is expressed on some brain tumors as well as some soft tissue sarcomas. And people are actually starting some trials, early phase trials in those tumors. So this cartoon just shows various generations, various iteration of the first generation anti-GD2 molecules. And the monoclonal 14G2A has not been used anymore. This was the first one designed. And then this one, which you probably might be familiar, especially if you have a team from New York here, 3F8, Sloan Kettering discovered this, Nikon Chung and his team, and I think they have been using this for close to a couple decades. It's a murine 14-18 antibody and has a short half-life of about 18 hours. And the current drug that was just recently approved, dinutuximab, is shown here in right. And it's actually genetically modified with a variable region from mice and constant region from human, and has a longer half-life of 66 hours. And so talking about mechanism of action of dinutuximab, I think we covered some of that, but it's an IgG1 chimeric monoclonal antibody, and it actually targets cell surface carbohydrate receptor GD2, present in neuroblastoma as well as peripheral nerves, and it actually attaches to GD2 and ultimately labels it so the normal immune cells, lymphocytes, neutrophils, and macrophages can come there and help kill neuroblastoma. It also works by activating complement and fixing complement by complement-dependent cytotoxicity, which is actually a minor effect for chimeric 14-18. This agent is also given with other immunomodulatory agents to enhance its ADCC, and the most commonly used are GM-CSF and IL-2. This cartoon just shows the surface expression, of GD2 and the chimeric 14-18, the murine part with the human component. And so going a little bit deeper into the mechanism of action and how it actually works and creates the good as well as the bad effect, ability of dinutuximab to actually activate complement, which is a minor effect for killing tumors, actually leads to complement activation, and it actually is responsible, its major side effect, pain. Pain is a result of complement activation. Knowing that, researchers at various institutions have been trying to navigate that and circumvent that, and I think group in St. Jude's have designed a humanized next-generation chimeric 14-18, which actually has a clever genetic modification in switching the lysine molecule to alanine to actually create a molecule which actually does not activate complement, and pain is supposed to be less. And in a comparative trial, it showed that it is not painless, but definitely pain is less when you use the humanized. This is an early stage of development, so ultimately these drugs will come along and make the therapy more manageable. But the approved agent, dinutuximab, is a chimeric, and it unfortunately does cause pain to the patients as soon as they start receiving it. When you use the humanized molecule and when you actually not activate the complement, it doesn't mean that it doesn't work, because complement activation is only very minor effect of the drug. So in a comparative efficacy, it's still very effective. So that is probably the future's way of going up, relatively less pain and same efficacy. This just talks about the anti-GD2 and specifically trials focusing on chimeric 1418 and now known as dinutuximab. And as you can see, the IND was actually filed before rituximab. This is how hard it is to develop drugs for pediatrics. So if you think about neuroblastoma, and if you have 800 new tumors and half of them are high risk, which are 400, and then you cure 35-40%, you're left with like 300 odd patients, and no company wants to develop drug for 300 patients. And that is the reality that's shown here. And so it took them this many years to actually do first phase one trial in 91, ultimately phase two trial. This is all single-handedly a perseverance and effort of LSU at UCSD, who actually championed this drug and ultimately finally brought it to 2000, where ultimately after convincing so many different and talking to so many companies, as you can see, the list goes on. This is her slide. This is her favorite slide. Even though phase two has shown activity in solid tumors, solid masses, neuroblastoma, which are relapsed with solid masses, and in a phase two trial, she has shown activity. No company wanted to take this drug on. And so finally, she went to the biopharmaceutical branch, and is under the orphan tumor and orphan drug category, they agreed to manufacture enough to do a phase three pivotal randomized trial, which was started in 2001. So this slide actually is the study schema, and clearly not meant to be read. What it just shows is before you actually go to dinutuximab therapy, patients has to receive this much therapy. So they receive, as we talked about, all the six cycles of chemotherapy, surgery, bone marrow transplant, radiation, and only patients who have either very minimal disease or no disease, these are the best responder, then they would go and receive immunotherapy. And the goal of immunotherapy for initial indication is to prevent relapse, not to treat disease. We'll talk about some of the trials which actually in a relapse setting that we have been doing, but this first trial, which ultimately led to FDA approval, was preventing relapse. And once the patients have gone through those, and those who were lucky enough to make it at the other end, then they get randomized to this trial, which LSU chaired and Children's Oncology Group ran, ANBL0032, where you have a standard arm of just retinoic acid maintenance, where you get 14 days on, 14 days off, 6 months of therapy, or you get retinoic acid with chimeric 1418 and GM-CSF for cycle 1, 3, and 5, shown in yellow, or you get IL-2 with chimeric and retinoic acid, shown in purple here. And the last cycle is just retinoic acid. And again, 6 months of therapy. And so the results of this trial were striking. When the trial, after all its stop and start and amendments, it's such a toxic therapy, it really took a lot of time to convince investigators to open, convince moms to put their kid on a drug which is causing so much pain after a year of god-awful therapy, to say, now you're going to get this so you don't relapse. So really it took a long time to convince. But as soon as first 226 patients and the first interim analysis was planned, the trial was stopped. Because as you can see, the event-free survival was almost 20% different. And this kind of number, 66 to 46, is not even heard of in neuroblastoma. And so the trial was stopped. Overall survival, again, as you can see, is highly significant. So both event-free and overall survival were significant. And ultimately, the randomization was fought, and everybody was switched over to the chimeric arm. Unfortunately, as it happens with cancer, as you know, this is the slide from Alice from a very recent update, where you can see the same 226 patients. The curves have actually come closer. So there are some late relapses on the immunotherapy arm. And so the event-free survival has become statistically non-significant, even though clinically it is significant. And this would be important because we'll talk about a relapse trial and see why this is important. But at the same time, there were some late relapses, which was really disheartening to a lot of people in neuroblastoma community. But that's a fact.
Ultimately, with these results, FDA did approve dinutuximab for initial therapy of high-risk neuroblastoma in maintenance to prevent relapse, and in March 2015. And in August, EMA, the European Medical Agency, also followed suit and approved dinutuximab for the similar indication. And so this, so far what data that we showed was for approved indication in an original trial. From here, what we're going to talk about is the newer approach is using the same drug and immunotherapy for different indication. So this is the trial that I run at COG, which is a phase 2 trial for relapse and refractory neuroblastoma. And first relapse and refractory neuroblastoma, people who have actually gone through all the treatment, and including chimeric antibody, if they fail, they are eligible for this phase 2 trial. Randomized, arm A receives irinotecan temozolomide with mTOR inhibitor temsirolimus, and arm B is irinotecan temozolomide with dinutuximab, cycles given every 21 days. And total 17 cycles allowed, which makes it for a one-year therapy. And in this, one notable absence is IL-2. So it is only used dinutuximab with GM-CSF, no IL-2 in this trial compared to the previous trial. And again, same story repeats itself. We just had our first interim analysis, and only 36 patients in both arms. But we needed just 3 responses in order for the trial to continue. And for the trial's primary endpoint, we only needed 7 responses. Within the first interim analysis and only half the patients, we showed that arm A, which is the temsirolimus arm, had only 5.5% responses, while 47% response. 47% response for first relapse neuroblastoma is again, early data, and very few patients. So please keep that caveat in mind. But this trial was actually stopped, and I think we are in process of talking to CTAP and FDA and others to reopen the trial as a single-arm trial with only arm B, and getting more immune correlates and trying to understand why these drugs work so well even in a relapse setting. And it just shows the event-free survival with arm arm B and arm A, highly statistically significant. Similarly, overall survival, clinically very significant, even though with a small number, they are not statistically significant. And this actually talks about the arm B, the chimeric arm, and the 8 patients who actually responded. And some of the things that I wanted to highlight, it actually just shows here that among the 8 patients who responded, there were patients who actually had relapse disease or they had refractory disease. By refractory, you mean, and the study definition meant you have given at least 5 high-dose chemotherapy cycles and patients has only stable disease or worse, and they have not had any RECIST measurable response. And patients obviously who progressed or relapsed were in there, and both type of patients actually responded. Similarly, patients who had measurable disease, which is like CT and MRI measured disease versus only on MIBG, bone or bone marrow disease, and those patients, and both kind of patients actually responded. And again, this is a very heartening and encouraging slide where it actually points that patients who had prior exposure also responded. So in other words, these were the patients who were Ellis's original trial. They were on the original trial, they responded, some of them were the late events that we just talked about, and those were enrolled on this trial and they still had response. And so this, we are hoping we can really capture this and ultimately help these patients even when they relapse, because we know from animal studies that GD2 does not down-regulate. So even when you have neuroblastoma patients who relapse, they still have expression of GD2 at a very high degree. And I think there is no, at least so far, we have not seen any resistance to dinutuximab, even in the setting of relapse. And that is a very encouraging sign. Another very important thing here to point out is all these responses are very long-lasting. The first response is now going to 22 months, which for neuroblastoma patients is considered significant. Anything more than 6 months is considered significant. And all these patients who have responded, all 8 of them, have not lost their best response. So if they had a PR, they are in PR, continue to be PR or better. And if they are in CR, they have been in CR. So that is really an exciting, and this is again, this is unpublished data. This is the first time we are presenting this, and I think ultimately we are really excited to open this trial again, to open for more patients. And again, now next few slides and very last few slides for me, I'm going to talk about some of the other immunotherapy approaches that investigators are using besides using the chimeric GD2. So the first two trials here enlisted are using the same molecule that we just talked about and the trials that we discussed, but Europe also has the similar trials ongoing right now. So Europe is doing the similar trials as we are doing. Then we have the 3FED, which is the murine 14-18 molecules, and Sloan Kettering has all these trials in various combination. They are using that drug with NK cell, post-transplant, and others, and using this. And now they also have humanized 3F8. So they have also moved on, just like St. Jude's, to really humanize their molecule. St. Jude's, as we talked about, has the humanized 14-18 and the one with the mutation, so it causes less pain. And they have trials ongoing for neuroblastoma as well as for other tumors like osteosarcoma and melanoma in children. The first CAR therapy is also ongoing for neuroblastoma at Baylor School of Medicine. And again, there are two vaccine trials, one at Baylor with oral cytoxin, and the second is Memorial Sloan Kettering using bivalent vaccine. So not only there are a chimeric antibody and dinutuximab, which is an approved therapy, is being used for neuroblastoma, but there are several other versions of second and third generation immunotherapy approach people are using to really improve the outcomes of this really poor risk patients. So I think with this, this is my summary slide before we move on to my other speakers. Just the take-home message for you guys survival for high-risk neuroblastoma, despite aggressive therapy, chemotherapy, surgery, autotransplant, radiation, still remains poor, and innovative biologics therapy and immunotherapy is really needed. Dinutuximab is the first approved agent, approved for first in the initial therapy of neuroblastoma in maintenance to prevent relapse. Early data, even though this is a non-approved indication, early data looks very encouraging for relapse patients using dinutuximab with chemotherapy. However, the point to remember is dinutuximab therapy has some very serious, predictable but serious side effects, and one that requires very careful monitoring, and one, a well-designed interprofessional approach would really help the patient population, and it is really needed for this, it is needed in general for pediatric oncology, but this is a tumor and this is a therapy where if you're going to have a multidisciplinary team, this is the therapy that you want to use it for. So, and that is one of the reasons we chose this symposium and the format that we chose, that I think this is a very good example where how we can use the other professionals to really use them. And so with this, I want to hand over the mic to Erica, who's going to take you through the administration and side effect profile.
Thank you. Before I begin, I just want to say, for the remainder of the presentation, me and my colleagues will be going back and forth presenting some slides, so we'll try to do it in a non-distracting way, but there will be a little bit of back and forth. So Dr. Modi did a great job explaining why it's very important to utilize immunotherapy in neuroblastoma, and I am tasked with bringing everybody down to earth to talk about how toxic it can be and how you can work to prevent those side effects. So the FDA has given two black box warnings to dinutuximab. The first one is for pain, as he discussed. This monoclonal antibody works by targeting GD2 on the cell surface receptors, and GD2 is also expressed on peripheral nerves, and so pain is very predictable with this medication. It's very severe. There's a neuropathic component of that, and so we'll talk about that further. Along with that, infusion-related reactions are common. It's a chimeric human mouse monoclonal antibody, so same types of infusion-related hypersensitivity or anaphylactic reactions you see with other monoclonal antibodies can be seen with dinutuximab. And then finally, there are some other serious side effects that we see with dinutuximab, but we also see with some of the concomitant therapies. And so hypotension, We'll talk about how we administer continuous infusion opioids with the dinutuximab so that can be compounded by opioid therapy. Some of the other immunotherapy that's given with dinutuximab can cause hypotension. Capillary leak is a particularly severe side effect that can occur, and so we'll talk about that as well. But you can see it with dinutuximab, and you can also see it predominantly with IL-2. And so that first study that Dr. Modi talked about where you give them both together, capillary leak is a very severe side effect that can occur. And then finally, fever. This medication causes lots of fevers, and our patients commonly experience fevers when they receive this antibody, and so that's another thing that we see frequently. So this is, again, a slide with a lot of small writing on it, but this just shows the patient population from the ALICE-U study that Dr. Modi talked about at the beginning and some of the side effects that we saw with that. And so neuropathic pain, which I've alluded to already, occurred in 52% of patients who were already receiving continuous infusion opioids. Hypotension occurred as well in 18% of patients. Again, this can be exacerbated by giving opioids. Fever without neutropenia occurred in almost 40% of patients. I would say we see at least that much in the patients that we've treated so far at our institution. Fever is very common. And then acute capillary leak syndrome occurred in a quarter of patients, and we'll explain which cycles that happen more commonly on the next slide. Hypersensitivity reactions, again, this is a monoclonal antibody, and then some lab abnormalities, specifically hyponatremia and hypokalemia. Those are seen fairly common, likely due to some fluid shifts in patients that are experiencing capillary leak, and then also some elevations of LFTs. So again, this is the same patient population. This is just looking at some of those more severe side effects broken out by cycle. And so the first one, pain, which we'll focus on the most, it does look that it may trend to less pain the more a patient is exposed to this medication. And what we don't know is if that trend is due to the treatment team becoming better at treating that patient's pain and learning what works for that patient over time and then just prospectively managing it more appropriately, or if there's some component of tachyphylaxis. And so that's some things that some scientists are trying to think through now and to see, you know, maybe if there's a tachyphylaxis component, particularly in Dr. Modi's study where there were 17 cycles of the dinutuximab, it wasn't uncommon for the patients to have less pain as they got further through the therapy. The next two, hypersensitivity reactions and capillary leak. Again, I've highlighted cycles 2 and 4. If you remember from the previous slides, those are the cycles where the dinutuximab was given with the IL-2. And so these side effects are much more common when given with concomitantly with IL-2. And then a similar slide, this is just from the patient population that Dr. Modi presented from the 1221 trial. So remember, these are patients with relapsed refractory disease, and arm B was the group that received the dinutuximab. Again, 50% of these patients had severe grade 3 or grade 4 pain, and that's going to be despite receiving continuous infusion opioids. Anaphylaxis rates are at 0. We'll kind of talk about some pre-meds, but we do pre-medicate these patients before they receive their medication. FNN positive blood cultures were at 0 in this trial. However, there was some patients that had hypotension as well as hypoxia and dyspnea. And I want to just focus for a second on this number right here because of one thing that we learned specifically with this trial. In the past, we had treated patients that had very minimal disease or were in complete remission. In this trial, it was a relapse refractory trial. And so there were patients that had pulmonary mets or lung disease or patients that had large abdomens and small lung volumes. And in those patients, when they started to develop capillary leak, their hypoxia and dyspnea could get severe very quickly. And so those are patients that really require a lot of monitoring, especially in those situations where they start to develop capillary leak because they can have respiratory compromise. So focusing on the pain with dinutuximab is severe, as you can tell, despite continuous infusion opioids, half of the patients will have grade 3 or grade 4 pain. It's acute. It starts right when you start the infusion of the dinutuximab. It's continuous throughout the infusion of the dinutuximab. For a lot of patients, it does resolve when the dinutuximab infusion is turned off. And so most of the time, you're able to wean off of the opioid before the next day's infusion starts. But we have found that that's not always the case. And so the vignette of the mother that you'll hear talk later, her child definitely had pain that did persist after we turned off the dinutuximab. And so every patient responds a little bit differently. As far as some barriers to adequate pain management, I just want to focus that these are young patients, and so they're toddlers. They can't tell you what hurts. They can't tell you what makes it feel better. So a lot of times it's really difficult not only for the patient and their family members to see their kid going through this pain, but it's also hard for the team to understand when they're in pain. Are they just agitated? Are they anxious? Is it true pain? Where is the pain and what's going to work the best? Additionally, we use different pain scales for children, and trying to figure out which one works the best is difficult for young children. And so there's a lot of barriers to really adequately identifying pain and treating pain in this patient population. And then finally, I want to just focus for a second on capillary leak. So again, this is another side effect that can occur with the nutuximab that can be really severe. Capillary leak, like we showed with the different cycles of ALIS-U study, is definitely more common when patients are concomitantly receiving IL-2. And so giving it with other therapies that can cause capillary leak increases your risk for developing it. However, the severity can also be exacerbated by the continuous infusion opioids, which can cause some hypoventilation and help lead to some more respiratory compromise. One thing that we've learned at our institution, and I think that is fairly well documented, is that anemia is also a coexisting risk factor for capillary leak. And so adequately transfusing patients, if they are anemic, for us, our transfusion thresholds are typically hemoglobins of 7 or 8. But on this protocol, they really want your hemoglobin above 10 if you start developing capillary leak. So utilizing packed red blood cell transfusions if necessary to make sure you're having that oxygen delivery. Again, increased risk with mediastinal disease, and then just the balance of managing intravascular depletion and hypotension. So usually the go-to would be to give IV fluids, and that still is recommended to acutely manage the hypotension, but you just don't want to flood the lungs in somebody that's become leaky and caused more respiratory compromise. And so it's a delicate balance. So I talked about red blood cell transfusion. You can also utilize albumin if the patient has an albumin less than 3. And then vasopressors can be used, and we've had that situation at our hospital where we've had to give somebody vasopressors for capillary leak. And then I just want to highlight, it's not on the slide, but absolutely you should stop the infusion of the dinutuximab or the IL-2 if somebody is getting into trouble with capillary leak, so that you can support them through it with some of these other therapies. In a second, I'll turn it over to Rhonda. So before we go through our patient case, just to how you administer dinutuximab. So we talked about some of the side effects. We start out with an IV bolus of normal saline, and then they get their opioid loading dose. We deliver all of this through our PCA. We preferentially use morphine, but we have had patients receive hydromorphone. And then they get Tylenol and Benadryl. That's prior to infusion because it is a monoclonal antibody and there are infusion-related reactions. We have learned over time the importance of initiating gabapentin prior to them coming in for their dinutuximab infusion. So we titrate that up over a 3-day period to their full dose. And so all of these things get started. And then once they get their loading dose of their morphine or Dilaudid, we start a continuous infusion of their morphine or Dilaudid so that it's all on board and those receptors are saturated. So once the dinutuximab starts, we hopefully have some adequate pain control at that point. As far as administering the dinutuximab, it's similar to other monoclonal antibodies, so you ramp up the rate. So you start at what is considered half rate, or 0.875 milligrams per meter squared. That goes for 30 minutes. And then after that, you go up to the full rate, which is 1.75 per meter squared per hour. And then if you do that, and you do not need to slow down the infusion or stop the infusion, for most hospitals, depending on how it's compounded, the infusion would end in 10 to 11 hours approximately. With this medication, the way it was studied, you have up to 20 hours to give a dose, and if that dose is not finished within the 20 hours, you would stop it and not give the rest of it, and then the next day would start after that. And so it's 4 days in a row for each cycle, so typically up to 10 to 11 hours for each dose, but you can slow it down for side effects up to 20 hours. Now I'm going to give it over to Rhonda.
Hi.
So hopefully what I'm going to do is review several patient cases for you so that you can see, it will demonstrate how we, our process of progression and how we came up with a plan of how best to treat these patients. And you will see from this many of the information that Erica covered as far as side effects, how it is that we treated them initially and how we progressed and are better managing these patients. So our first patient is a 14-year-old male who had stage 4 neuroblastoma with widely metastatic disease, primarily osseous disease. He, as Dr. Modi had stated in the previous protocols, had received 6 cycles of induction chemotherapy and had gross total resection of his tumor. Disease evaluation following that resection showed that he had small areas of MIBG, avid disease, and he was graded as a very good partial response. He then underwent autologous bone marrow transplant, followed by radiation to the tumor, primary tumor site, as well as the sites that were still active for positive disease after transplant. And as at the time of his progression onto immunotherapy, he had a complete response and had no signs of active disease. During the first cycle of his immunotherapy, we readily identified that there was going to be an issue as far as available lumens, venous access. He only had a single lumen metaport, and so in order to be able to give the detuximab as well as the supportive care, we needed to place a peripheral IV on this child. We started morphine, both as a continuous infusion as well as bolus, but in spite of our best efforts, he had significant intractable pain, which required additional doses of morphine as well as slowing down of the detuximab rate. He also had complications with nausea and vomiting, decreased urinary output, and weight gain, which was managed with additional IV fluids, as well as he was found to have anemia, and we gave packed red blood cells as well. During cycle 2, again, we had multiple line issues. We had, during the course of his treatment, which would have been a week, he necessitated 4 different peripheral IVs because we just had difficulty maintaining that line. Again, we started his morphine drip, adjusting it based upon what he had required in the previous cycle. He continued to have inadequate pain control with inconsolable crying and whimpering, which was very distressful for the family. Then we went on to cycle 3. Again, we had anticipated that we might have issues with available lumen. So at that point in time, we placed a PICC line in addition to his metaport. Again, we started with utilizing continuous morphine and a PCA based upon his previous cycles. On day 1, he had significant pain. His mother was quite distressed and said, "I have never seen him in this kind of pain." We bolused him with morphine. We also gave lorazepam for agitation. Again, in a 14-month-old, it's difficult to know exactly what they're experiencing. Unfortunately, we were not able to have provide relief for this child, and the mother elected to withdraw this child from protocol. So they stopped treatment after 3 cycles. The downward effect of that was, or the downtrend effect, as many of you know, or at least in the pediatric population, many of our parents talk to each other and talk about treatment, what their child is experiencing. So this mother relayed this information to many other families, and there were at least a couple of families that made the decision that they didn't want to proceed with this therapy due to his response.
So just to summarize with this patient case, there are some identified issues that we as a group recognized with this first vignette. The first one, we do not think that the parent was appropriately counseled about expectations prospectively, which led to some tension in the room when the patient did have these side effects. Clearly, when he was in pain, we were having open dialogue with her and kind of explaining what was going on and trying to get ahead of that. But one thing that we did learn was maybe trying to set that up prospectively so they knew what to expect going into the therapy versus reacting to that pain. The patient did have inadequate pain control, and there were some varied approaches between some of the teams that were taking care of this patient. And so at this time, our main teams that were involved in treatment of these patients were the PEDS Hematology Oncology Service, as well as our acute pain service. And our acute pain service is more adept to treating post-op pain and relying on boluses and demand doses. And so you may not have noticed, but the PCA settings per cycle for this patient didn't really change a whole lot. When he got into pain, they would come in and try to bolus him, and it was more reactive. And so I think what we learned from that was to be more proactive and have more pain control delivered through a continuous approach, because the infusion is continuous. And so there was just, not that one approach is right or wrong, but there was just differences of opinions at that time. And then inadequate venous access is continually a problem when the patient is getting into trouble or having pain or needing supportive care, and you can't give it because there's not appropriate lines. I'm sure you guys have all had patients in that situation. And so, again, trying to be proactive with that. These are kind of some of the things we learned from him. And then Rhonda will talk through another case.
So case number two is a 24-month-old female who also had stage 4 neuroblastoma with widely metastatic disease, primarily osseous disease. She also received 5 cycles of induction chemotherapy, followed by gross resection. Fortunately, at the time of gross resection, she was in complete remission. So she progressed on to autologous bone marrow transplant as well as radiation to the primary tumor bed. And at the time of when she was going to move on to immunotherapy, she continued to remain in remission. During cycle one, we had at that point in time already established that we were going to start patients preemptively on gabapentin in order to help with that neuropathic pain. So the patient is gradually titrated up to 10 milligrams per kilogram over 3 days prior to their admission. She fortunately did fairly well, and her pain was pretty well controlled with standard, what we had identified would be standard continuous morphine with, at this point in time, we had changed in our clinical practice to have it be nurse-controlled anesthesia so that the nurse actually had control over whether the child was getting bolus morphine. And she had good pain management. She also developed fevers, which did not escalate to anything else, so we just observed and treated those appropriately. And she had intermittent mild hypotension, but it did not require or necessitate any interruption, and she was able to complete the cycle. During cycle two, her pain was well controlled on the above, the previous cycle's management with gabapentin, with the addition of gabapentin, as well as continuous and bolus morphine. She developed hypotension during only one episode with blood pressure, systolic blood pressures into the 60s. We paused the infusion of the dentuximab and gave IV fluids, and she was able to receive the rest of the infusions without any other problems. She did develop fevers up to 41 degrees Celsius. So we did a complete septic workup. She was non-neutropenic, so we started cefepime empirically, and all cultures came back negative. So for cycle three, again, at this point in time, we had pretty much resolved or had been successful in managing her pain. Although she continued to have daily fevers, again, septic workup was done. All cultures were negative, and she was able to complete that cycle. Unfortunately, though, during cycle four, she developed fluid refractory hypotension, and along with bilateral petechial edema and delayed capillary refill. So both the IL-2, because she was receiving IL-2 in cycle four, so both the IL-2 and the denutuximab were placed on hold. And in spite of fluid boluses, she continued to be hypotensive and also anuria. So we elected to transfer her to the PEDS ICU for closer monitoring, and also eventually she was started on pressors. When she became hemodynamically stable and she had been off pressors for greater than 24 hours, we resumed the denutuximab at 50% infusion rate, and she was able to complete the cycle, although we continued to hold the IL-2.
So identified issues for the second patient case, as Rhonda showed, we actually did a pretty good job with her pain, and she tolerated the therapy fairly well until cycle 4, and then cycle 4 everything went downhill and she ended up in the ICU on vasopressor support. So drastic improvement in pain control with the prospective addition of gabapentin. However, balancing that fine line of managing capillary leak on the floor is very difficult, and so that was something that we got firsthand experience with as far as plan for how do you reinitiate immunotherapy in a patient who is receiving epinephrine in a PICU. And so when do you restart it? When you take off the epinephrine, which one do you restart? What rate do you start? Do you give both or do you hold the IL-2? So these are all discussions and issues that we had to kind of work through and talk to the study coordinator to figure out how to best take care of this patient. And then just the ongoing consensus management for persistent fevers. Do you start antibiotics? How long do you keep antibiotics on? When you are fairly certain that the reason the patient's having fevers is because of the medication and not because of an infection. So kind of going over all of those identified areas of improvement, we met multiple times with the Peds Hematology Oncology Group and several of the other groups that helped to take care of these patients. And the one thing that we just absolutely decided is that we needed to have a standardized process when these patients came in, where all of the teams were on the same page, it was written out, it was easy for nurses, overnight staff, everybody to access and to follow our protocols, and that everybody bought into our protocols and that they were approved. And so we wrote a clinical practice guideline for how to take care of these patients when they're admitted, which I'll show you a piece of. Part of that clinical practice guideline focused on pain management and making sure that we all had the same thought process for how pain management should be undertaken. Again, it's a guideline. We could have refractory patients that don't follow that guideline, but at least being on the same page in initiation as far as prospective management for pain. Optimization of available lumens. We have learned that 2 lumens is minimum, and there are some cycles where 3 lumens is minimum, depending on compatibility between some of the medications and some of the pain regimens. If a patient were to need hydromorphone, there's less compatibility information with hydromorphone and IL-2, for example, and so certainly sometimes we even need 3 lumens. And then the interprofessional approach, again, we'll talk more about this with Beth from palliative care and family-centered care, but these are huge. These patients require a lot of supportive care, and so really bringing everybody's best expertise to the table has really been something that has helped us tremendously with these patients. So just going back to our clinical practice guideline, the document that we created, this slide goes over some of the things that it includes. One is a pre-immunotherapy multidisciplinary clinic visit. Again, if you go back to patient one, we just felt that maybe we didn't prospectively set them up with enough education to know what to expect. And so Beth will talk more about what things are included in that clinic visit, but that's included in our clinical practice guideline. Appropriate supportive care. So again, our first patient did not get gabapentin prospectively. It's something that we learned over time that if you look at the data, it seems pretty clear, regardless of continuous infusion opioids, half of the patients will experience severe pain. It makes sense that it's a neuropathic pain. Maybe opioids are not the best medication to treat this. And so we have really learned over time that initiating gabapentin upfront is huge. And so that is now standard for us. And so we have that outlined in our clinical practice guideline, what dose to start, how to titrate it up, and how to titrate it down between cycles. I think that there are some centers that just keep it on between cycles. I don't think there's a right or wrong approach, but we kind of outline what our approach is in our guideline. Again, predetermined guidelines for acute pain management and escalation. We have determined specific workflows for initiation of the PCA, if it's cycle 1, so kind of starting from scratch versus subsequent cycles, and making sure that we are taking into account what the patient required on the previous admissions, what worked well, and documenting that consistently so that when they come back in the next time, we're not reinventing the wheel. And so all of that is outlined, really, really focusing on a proactive, prospective approach versus the reactive approach, which we learned the hard way is doesn't work. And then algorithms for treatment of hypotension and capillary leak. It's just important to have these easily ready for the nurse to be able to grab it and know what to do in the situation instead of trying to log in and sift through a 400-page protocol to determine what the right thing is. And so we tried to be proactive and include that as well.
This is just a snapshot example of our opioid nomogram. It only covers like just the top part of our flow sheet. But just to give you guys an idea, the first box kind of talks about our loading dose and what we would use, and then it separates out whether it's course one or subsequent courses for our PCA, how we determine our demand doses, how we determine our continuous infusion doses, how we document it in the chart, who documents it, et cetera. And then at the bottom part, which you can't see, it even goes so far as to say when you reevaluate your patient, if they're hitting their button more than one time an hour, how you calculate what changes to do in the continuous infusion, who is responsible for calling who is responsible for evaluating the patient. Everything is laid out, and all of the teams that play a role in that process are educated on this and buy into this method, and so nobody's guessing or assuming that somebody's doing something and then it gets missed.
But based on our identified areas of improvement, which Erica talked about, we recognize the importance of interprofessional approach and family-centered care. There is now an institutional commitment to this partnership, recognizing that the family is really part of the team. And the goal is to foster communication between the families and providers and to facilitate quality patient care that addresses the physical and psychosocial needs of our patients and families. So research has long suggested that interprofessional collaboration really improves coordination, communication, and ultimately the quality and safety of patient care. This kind of care is demonstrated based on the five principles displayed here. I would emphasize the importance of effective communication, recognizing this is not just an exchange of information. It's really about understanding the emotions and the intention behind the information. This is the glue to help you deepen your connections with others, to help you improve teamwork, decision-making, and problem-solving. So to execute interprofessional care and effective communication, we've utilized the role of champions. We've identified passionate learners who are among the disciplines in our institution, who are well-versed in our clinical practice guideline, and obviously committed to improving patient outcomes. Like Erica briefly mentioned, we meet prior to the initiation of therapy. These champions come together. We provide the patient and family education regarding the therapy and the additional resources available to them during their admission. This is all done in the outpatient setting prior to their initial admission. These champions consist of representatives from our pediatric hematology oncology team. Often it's a nurse practitioner, a bedside nurse, and the pharmacist. In addition, there's a representative from the palliative care team, acute pain service, and child life specialist team. Additionally, the social workers, spiritual care providers, and PICU colleagues are also notified of the anticipated admission. And then throughout the other inpatient cycles, the champions continue to collaborate and reevaluate our CPG.
So I'm just going to briefly discuss this for the sake of time. And basically, you're going to see how we've kind of come full circle and how hopefully we've made headway into treating these patients and can continue to do so with limited or at least having a better handle on side effects. So our last patient is a 3-year-old male who also had stage 4 neuroblastoma with extensive metastatic disease. He also was treated with 6 cycles of chemotherapy and underwent surgical resection following that. And unfortunately, at the time of his surgery, his pathology revealed that he had positive margins and less than 9, and only had about 5% of tumor necrosis. 95% of his tumor was active. So following that induction chemotherapy, disease evaluation showed that he still had significant MIBG avid disease in his bone marrow. So the decision at that time, given his age and behavioral issues with this particular patient, that he wasn't a candidate for MIBG therapy or autologous bone marrow transplant. So he was enrolled onto the newest study that Dr. Modi talked about, which fortunately he was randomized to the regimen B cycle, or the regimen B. So he got 17 cycles of regimen B, which included the standard chemotherapy of temozolomide and irinotecan for 5 days, as well as the addition of dentuximab, as well as GM-CSF. He experienced multiple adverse events during this as far as he had pain in all 17 cycles. He had fever in 7 of those cycles. hypotension in 4 of those cycles, nausea and vomiting in 3, hypoxia in 3 cycles, and rash in 2. So you can see that we pretty much had the same profile as what was reported when Erica talked about side effects. The good news is, after the completion of these 17 cycles, he was in complete remission and remains so currently. And despite the family's hesitancy and anxiety prior to starting this therapy, and after 17 cycles of therapy that obviously had significant side effects, including pain, the mom's reply to us was, "Do we have to stop this drug? Why can't we just keep on giving it to him? He responded so well to it." So it just goes to show how these parents can appreciate that if they stay the course and follow this, that there hopefully will be success.
So I just want to quickly highlight, we've talked about a lot of pharmacologic ways to intervene with these patients and provide supportive care. There's obviously lots of non-pharmacologic ways as well. Again, these patients are very young. So the one that we have benefited from the most is Child Life, having them involved before they get admitted, trying to learn what the patient likes, what is a good distraction for them, has been huge. And so we've really utilized our Child Life team to come and do distraction techniques and play games with our patients and really get their mind off of the pain. Additionally, another learning point, expect the unexpected. As you can tell from the 3 patients we talked about, they were all very different. And even between cycles, potentially were very different. And so for us, we have our guideline and we have our standard, you know, morphine PCA or dilated PCA that we utilize up front. And kind of we cross our fingers and hope that that's going to be effective for the patient. But when we have that pre-clinic meeting before their first cycle, we do talk to the families about plan B and plan C if those don't work. And so for us, our plan B is a lidocaine infusion if the opioids are not working. That would require a transfer to the PICU. And so we talk to the families before they come in and say transferring to the PICU is something that could happen in order for us to provide adequate pain relief. And it doesn't necessarily mean that your son or your daughter is acutely ill or decompensating. It just provides us a safer place to give different types of medications and more monitoring. So we talk them through that process so that they are aware that that could happen. Other institutions could switch to fentanyl. I know that there are some other places that have been looking at using ketamine or propofol. And so these are all different things or techniques that have been utilized that could be your plan B or your plan C at your institution.
So really our mission is to provide evidence-based pain and symptom management as defined in our CPG and to reinforce an interprofessional team approach as a standard of care. This is definitely easier said than done. Our goal is to reduce inconsistent practices, improve patient comfort and compliance, and enhance team member collaboration. We are currently implementing this through a patient and family therapy guide, patient experience survey, and quarterly reviews. This is just a snapshot of our patient and family therapy guide. This is distributed during our outpatient visit prior to initiation of therapy. This educational tool is really intended to help our patients and families to better understand the treatment regimen. It highlights the medication information, the glossary of terms, the calendar and treatment of schedule, anticipated adverse effects, and the teams and resources available to them. This is a snapshot of our patient experience survey. This is also distributed to them following each cycle. Our goal is to really better understand that patient's treatment and symptoms they experienced, to identify if there are any patient trends, and to improve patient outcomes. Unfortunately, surveys do not capture the emotions, and they do not tell our patients and families stories. So we recognize the importance of going straight to the source. Now we're going to have the opportunity to listen to a mother's reflection as she talks about her son's journey through the dinutuximab antibody therapy. This slide displays the 8 questions that we interviewed her with, and you're going to have a chance to listen to the audio response following each question. We first asked the mother, from her point of view, to please describe what this treatment was like for her.
It has been difficult, but in that aspect, it's been difficult because of trying to understand what reactions are from what. knowing if it's from the, which specific medicine is causing what problem. That has been our biggest concern, I think, throughout this whole thing, and then understanding that your child is going to be in pain, and then trying to focus on the fact that that pain is going to make him better, knowing that it's going to help their situation to prolong their life.
We then asked what advice she would give other patients or families starting the treatment regimen.
The best piece of advice I could give somebody would be to make sure that they, if their child is old enough, to talk with them about what kind of things they think is going to help them when they're not feeling good. If it's a matter of having some kind of a word or a signal so that the parent knows what's going on. So that way, if your child is in a lot of pain, there's a way for you to know that without having to pester them constantly. Are you okay? Are you in pain? Do you need this? Do you need that? Kind of a thing. And making sure that your child is aware of what's going on, and to maybe have like, I know with us specifically, we talked about, okay, so when you're going to get into that pain, what can we do to get your mind off of it? And Child Life was a great help with that as well. And just to have something already in place, so when it gets to that point, you're like, okay, we talked about this. Now, this is what we're going to do to try to help you get through this step. I think that that's just pretty important to have that kind of a thing with your child to help them get through that, because, and them understanding if they're old enough, that is, to what it's going to be like without scaring the heck out of them.
For healthcare providers who do not have experience with this treatment regimen, we asked her what would be helpful for them to know or to consider.
That they need to listen to the parents when the parents are telling them that there's something going on or that there's pain going on, and to communicate with the nurses, because most of the time the nurses know these kids already. And to understand, like, okay, we already know that this is what's going on. We tried everything before we even called you in. And for them, if they're not sure what to do next, to go in the hallway and ask somebody who does, or to get advice, for them not to just pull at straws in front of the patient. Sometimes it's best if they just go out of the room and they can think out loud or whatever they need to do, just not in front of the patient when the patient's in severe pain at that very moment. You know, it's not a good thing for to see a new person, like, stumbling, because at that point, a parent just wants somebody to help their kid and to fix them.
Next, we asked her, how did having a team approach affect her son's care?
I think it helped tremendously. I think that with the different teams, mainly the palliative care and the acute pain care, like, they had different things in their back pockets that they knew that could help. If one aspect of the medicine is causing a certain pain, they had other ideas of what could help relieve some of that pain. And then with Child Life stepping in as well and trying to give different ideas to the children and to the parents of what to do to try to help get through it, I think that's just been such a blessing to have multiple people, like, having ideas, and when they're actually communicating with each other, it's fabulous.
Next, we asked her, what has been the most difficult part of this treatment regimen for both her and her son?
I think the most difficult part has been the fact that my son has had the extended pain and side effects after treatment has finished, and we were kind of prepped that once the infusion was done, the pain would stop, and that hasn't been our case. And knowing each child is always an individual, but, and then honestly, with some of the pains that he was experiencing and the side effects, the anxiety of have we relapsed, that has been the most difficult, is just worrying about the relapse because of the side effects.
Next, we asked, have there been any interventions that have made this difficult treatment regimen more tolerable?
I think in our case, having the extra different types of medicine that were available has been super helpful. So, like, if something isn't working or he just needs that little extra oomph, it's helped, and that's made it easier on him to get through it. And the fact that the nursing staff and the doctors really do take into consideration how each kid copes with everything. So where my son likes it nice and dark and quiet and not a ton of people in his room, they're very respectful of that. And I think that that makes everything easier when the people that are trying to help your son are actually like paying attention that it is your child and that it's, you know, not just another number or just another patient, that they're very caring. And that just makes everything easier.
We then asked if there were any interventions that were not done that you think would be beneficial in the future.
That one's a little bit more difficult. I don't really think that there was anything necessarily specific that I wish would have been done other than maybe understanding the side effects of some of the other medications. I think that it's concentrated on this is the side effects that are possible for during the chimeric or the IL-2, but it's not really discussed all the other side effects that come with taking the other medicines, the gabapentin, the leukine, that kind of stuff. And I think sometimes that would have been a little bit more helpful to know what to expect instead of being like, what's wrong with my kid, when really there's a good chance it's just a side effect from one of the other medicines as well.
In conclusion, we asked her if there was anything else that she would like to share with our team.
I think that you guys are doing a fabulous job with knowledge is power and trying to put that knowledge and having everybody on the same team. I really do just think that will keep improving as you guys go, and that's just going to be more and more helpful for the kids. And as more doctors are aware of this treatment, it's just going to make it easier.
This mother really answered from her heart, and I think that it highlights some of our successes but also rooms for continued improvement. I'm going to let Erica take over from here.
So we're going to summarize this really fast, and then we'll go to your questions for your CE credit. So in summary, Dr. Modi outlined the benefits of dinutuximab therapy and immunotherapy in neuroblastoma, and then we have also kind of illustrated a lot of the side effects and the toxicity profile. The side effects are predictable, but they are serious. And so really having that team approach and a proactive approach for preventing them. Well-planned multidisciplinary approaches are instrumental. Different concomitant therapies as well as progressive cycles can change the landscape of the side effects that we're seeing with the nutuximab. And in addition, the next generation or humanized anti-GD2 monoclonal antibody therapies may potentially decrease some of the side effects that we're seeing by decreasing that complement-dependent cytotoxicity. So hopefully a lot of these side effects either are eliminated or downplayed in the future just based off of our improvements in our technologies with these therapies. So we can go to the questions first. I think you guys have been doing the text question web-based all day, so you should be familiar with this format. So the first question is, which of these statements regarding the role of dinutuximab in the treatment of high-risk neuroblastoma is the most appropriate? It should be used for all patients who have relapsed following upfront therapy. It should be given to everyone as soon as they are diagnosed. It is an approved therapy for both frontline and relapsed high-risk neuroblastoma. Or it's an approved therapy for use after chemotherapy plus surgery plus autotransplant and radiation in the frontline therapy of high-risk neuroblastoma. Oh, good job. So you guys were listening pretty good. So I think the tricky answer here that got a few of you guys is the selection A. It should be used for all patients who have relapsed following upfront therapy. That's more of the setting of that 1221 study that Dr. Modi is the PI for. And I think this is still experimental. The numbers look great, but it's still just small numbers at this point in time. So I don't think you can say that it should be used for all of these patients yet until we get some more data. But the last one would be the one that would be the correct answer, which would be for upfront therapy for high-risk neuroblastoma, but in maintenance to prevent relapse after they've received all of those other therapies that we talked about that led to still some pretty crappy long-term outcomes. You would add this immunotherapy to the end. The next question, JH is a patient with high-risk neuroblastoma who is in complete remission at time of transplant. He's now due for immunotherapy with dinutuximab, GM-CSF, and IL-2. Which of the following best describes the mechanism of action of dinutuximab?
So is it a small molecule tyrosine kinase inhibitor that works intracellularly on the GD2 pathway to downregulate neuroblastoma cells? Is it an immunomodulatory agent that activates cellular immunity and leads to production of cytokines? Is it a monoclonal antibody against cell surface GD2 that labels cells for immune destruction? Or a colony-stimulating factor that triggers proliferation and differentiation of hematopoietic progenitor cells? Good. So it's C. So let me see if... Okay, so small... Answer A is kind of trying to trick you up. So small molecule tyrosine kinase inhibitor. So it does work on GD2. So that's right, except GD2 is located on the cell surface. And so that's how the monoclonal antibodies target it on the cell surface versus it being an intracellular tyrosine kinase mediated mechanism. And then the second one, immunomodulatory agent that activates cellular immunity and leads to production of cytokines. That would be more typical of like your IL-2 type of therapy. Sorry. All right, so question 3, JH has started immunotherapy, is currently receiving dinutuximab and high-dose IL-2 on cycle 2, day 7. He's experiencing 8 out of 10 pain as well as increased weight gain, tachypnea, and desaturations into the high 80s. Which of the following interventions should not be considered? Stop dinutuximab and the IL-2 infusions, continue your morphine PCA, and provide supplemental oxygen. Slow your dinutuximab or IL-2 infusions, continue your morphine PCA with an additional bolus of morphine for pain, and provide supplemental oxygen. Keep your dinutuximab and IL-2 infusions the same, bolus your morphine for pain control, as well as give a dose of lorazepam for presumed anxiety. Or stop dinutuximab and IL-2 infusions and consult the PICU for an evaluation. Oh, it's shrinking. Well, the last one's shrinking. That's good. So the answer is C. So what you would not want to do is keep dinutuximab IL-2 infusions the same, bolus morphine for pain control, as well as give Ativan. And the main reason for this is just in a patient who is already tachypnic and desatting, you probably want to have some supplemental oxygen as part of your treatment plan. In addition, likely these side effects would improve if you either at least slow down the infusion or stop the infusion of the dinutuximab and the IL-2. So the first thing we would do is either slow those down or stop those completely, give supplemental oxygen, get ahead of the problem. Additionally, you could still provide opioid pain medication because the patient is in pain, but you would want some supplemental oxygen to make sure he's not desatting further. Whereas in selection C, it just boluses some more morphine without the supplemental oxygen in a patient that's tachypnic and desatting. So that would be the answer we would stay away from, realizing that there are a lot of different ways to treat this patient, and so there's not one right answer. And then the last question, all of the following are key components except for which one that should be utilized when caring for a patient receiving immunotherapy. Family-centered care, interprofessional team approach, reactive pain management, or effective communication. Good. So C, reactive pain management. I do want to emphasize that reactive pain management is likely to be part of your patient care because you will have patients that get into pain that you need to react to. However, really what we have learned and hopefully demonstrated over time that the prospective, proactive treatment approach is something that really gets better outcomes in the long run. So that's all for the questions. I think we will conclude with Dr. Modi doing acknowledgments.
So again, I just want to acknowledge a lot of important people who actually made this talk possible. I guess the first one would be the three sitting on the stage. And I just wanted to thank Erica, Rhonda, and Beth for helping me put together a very nice symposium. And I hope you guys truly enjoyed or learned from it. And so thanks to my colleagues. Also want to thank several other members who are not here but part of our other multidisciplinary team, including Judy, Dr. Pirich, Trish Kiffer, Sandra Merkel, who are part of either palliative care team or a pain team, and some of the ICU attendings, including Dr. Nidner, and our nursing floor nursing team as well as the child life team. Most important that... We all like to thank and really learn and cues from is our patients and families. I think without their support and their desire to enroll on trial and trust their kids' life with us, none of this would be possible. So I just wanted to thank everybody else. Thanks for staying awake. It looks like you guys actually did pretty well on questions and answers. And so I think this is for CME credit. I think there is a link there for educational credit. And again, I want to thank everybody. And this is our home at CS Mott Children's Hospital in a very contemporary fall shot, actually. And just for the record, this is one time when we come here to Phoenix and Michigan is warmer than Phoenix. Just want to stay there for the record.
This concludes this podcast from the 2015 JAD Pro Live at AppShow Conference. To view these slides and claim your educational credit, or to view other programs from this meeting, please visit education.annenberg.net/JADProLive2015.